I'm going to speak eventually about the confluence of several crises that are coming to the fore. You know what I'm talking about, especially with respect to the ecology crisis and the economic crisis. And I want to talk about how that plays out with respect to civil liberties. But before I do that, I wanted to share a story with you. We wouldn't be here but for 9/11 and the attacks on the World Trade Center. I live in Battery Park City, a block away from the World Trade Center, and my law office is about this far on the other side of the hole from Ground Zero. So on 9/11, I was supposed to be up having lunch at Windows on Breakfast, having windows on Windows on the World, you know, that restaurant on top of the building that was hit. And my friend John called me at the last moment. I was supposed to be there at 8 o'clock, and he said, "I've got a meeting, I can't come." So I was actually in my apartment bed when the first plane hit, and my wife Debbie said, "What was that?" I said, "You know, it had to be a car accident. What else?" And she said, "Could you go down and take a look?" So I went down, and I looked up, and the building was on fire. So I came back, and I reported that. And then I thought, you know, I better call up John and tell him that if we would have gone to breakfast that day, we wouldn't have got out of there all day. So I'm on the phone with John telling him, and just as I was announcing this mishap with a little plane, the second plane flew right over my apartment. Building shook, and whang, you know. So then Debbie said, "We're being attacked." And I thought, you know, this is going to change things. In the same way, I remember when John Kennedy was killed, and I thought, I hope it's not a black guy, because this is going to change things too. And, you know, sure enough, the first building came down, and the whole neighborhood turned night, like inside of a closet. Then it kind of lightened up again, and the second building came down, and it turned dark again. And I'm up there with my wife, Debbie, and I've got a big 16-pound gray cat, and I've got a talking parrot, Charlie Parker, you know, because he's a bird. So we thought, well, what are we going to do? We're not really not portable. So we stayed overnight, and it was untenable. There was no electricity, there was no gas, there was no water, no nothing. So the next day, and the cops came, and they cleared us out. So we left the cat, but we took the bird in his cage, and we started walking up towards Michael Ratner's house in the Village, because he and Karen promised that we could stay in the basement and live there. So we're walking up with Charlie in the cage, and the bird is telling everybody we encounter, "It's okay, it's okay." But it wasn't okay. And 3 weeks later, the bird starts nodding out and falling off his perch. So we rushed him up to the Animal Medical Center. Only in New York, they've got a veterinarian that specializes in treating avian illness. So we bring him to this doctor. She checks him out, puts in an IV, and she says he's got avian respiratory disease from the schmutz in the air. And I said, "All right." And she said, "Well, I think we can save him, but it'll be $900, please." I said, $900? He was a victim of terrorism. She says, "In that case, we've set up a special fund. There's no charge." So they gave him antibiotics. He lived through it. We brought him home. We could never get back into our office because we couldn't get a telephone. So we wound up taking all of our files and putting them on the kitchen table right next to where the bird cage is. We spent a year practicing law next to this talking bird. And I'll come to the point of my story. One morning, Debbie was on the phone with an insurance company adjuster, because we sue insurance companies for injured people. And she's trying to settle a case. And the guy was giving her a hard time. And the bird could pick up on it because he could hear it. And he started walking back and forth on his perch. He's getting more and more agitated. He's very protective of Debbie, loves Debbie. And finally, he couldn't stand it any longer. And he yelled out in my tone of voice, "I'm going to kick your ass." And if you don't remember anything else from what I'm saying, that's what in the felicitous term of Gore Vidal, the Bush-Cheney oil and gas junta has done to us with respect to civil liberties. So I want to talk about what we used to have, what we've got now, and how that, what we've got now, plays out if a pre-revolutionary situation develops in this country because of the confluence of crises that we now see coming into fore. We had what Marxists called bourgeois democracy. And it was very limited and restrictive. Initially, of course, because black people weren't whole people, women couldn't vote, there's no economic democracy, but nonetheless, it was an advance over feudalism and what had preceded it. The founding fathers tried to figure out a way to limit executive power. So if you read the Federalist Papers, they have this discussion on how to do it. And they figure they'll set up an executive who's also commander-in-chief, so that's dangerous. So you give Congress the right to declare war. And you have a legislature that passes the laws, not the executive. And you have a judiciary that decides disputes on those laws. And if you have a balance of forces amongst the three tripartite form of government, that'll rein in the executive. Well, that's one of our problems now. The second one is with respect to the Bill of Rights. In 1789, when these discussions were going on about the new Constitution, the people who made the American Revolution, the people with the guns, you know, the farmers and the tradesmen and so on, said, we don't want this Constitution if it doesn't have a Bill of Rights. And the big states particularly pressured them, New York, Massachusetts, Virginia. And the Bill of Rights was passed, and that was made part of the Constitution. And in particular, the First Amendment, which discusses freedom from religion. Remember, a lot of the founding fathers were not Christians. They remembered what kind of oppression happened from a fusion of Christianity and state power in Europe, like the Inquisition, for example. First Amendment also covers freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom to listen. The Second Amendment, right to bear arms. The Fourth Amendment, right to privacy. The Fifth Amendment, due process, right to be treated fairly. The Sixth Amendment, the right to have an attorney. Fifth Amendment, in terms of you can't be forced to incriminate yourself, you can't testify against yourself, you're free from torture. All these were discussed and put into the Constitution. Every single one of them is under attack as a result of 9/11. The police state, which had been picking up steam, you could argue, after the United States emerged triumphant in the Second World War, that motion was tremendously accelerated after 9/11. Now, how did it happen? The two keys are, a week after 9/11, on the 18th of September, the authorization to use military force passed by Congress, Republicans and Democrats. Never forget that the Democrats were the handmaidens to this process and facilitated it. And then the military order number one. The government's view is that the attacks of September 11 were part of an act of war and not just a crime. This view is based on the congressional resolution, the authorization for the use of military force, which grants special powers to the executive branch. It stipulates that, this is a quote, this is what it says, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against those nations, organizations, or persons he determines planned, authorized, committed, or aided the terrorist attacks that occurred on 9/11. And Jean-Claude Pay wrote a very good article in Monthly Review in November of 07. And Pay says, the interpretation that the executive makes of this resolution is the expression of a state at war, not against other nations, but against organizations or ordinary individuals that are not linked to a foreign government. This interpretation redefines the concept of war. It gives it an asymmetrical character, a fight to the death between world superpower and persons designated as enemies. Then came the turning point. 2 months later, on the 18th of November, Bush's military order number one. And this was what you might call a coup. Michael Ratner wrote a couple months ago on the anniversary of this law, as he says, I remember thinking to myself that there's just been a coup d'etat in America. Perhaps an exaggeration, but nonetheless a watershed moment in a country that I still thought had some semblance of a democracy and of the principle that presidential authority was under law. As most of you may not recall the order, let me remind you of its three key provisions. First, the president claimed the authority to capture, kidnap, or otherwise arrest any non-citizen. It was later extended to citizen. Anywhere in the world, including the United States, whom the president believed was involved in international terrorism, and hold them forever without any charges, proceedings, or trial. Amazing. A person could be held forever just because the president wanted them to be held. He took on the power to disappear people. Second, the order did provide that if, and if is the crucial word here, if the person was tried, there was never needed to be a trial, such trials were to be held by special ad hoc courts called military commissions. These commissions had no resemblance to trial courts. The entire proceeding could take place in secret, with evidence from torture, and those found guilty could be executed in secret. Third, to the extent the names of those imprisoned or tried could be determined and lawyers found, no court could hear any case. This order embodies within it the violations of fundamental rights we are facing today: indefinite detention without trial, Guantanamo, secret sites, special trials, and disappearances. While it does not mention torture, that appears to have come a bit later, a secret detention system is part and parcel of a torture system. Let's also repeat, this was a military order in a society and country that was still or purported to be under civilian rule. This order, more than any other single document, embodies our lost liberties. It was this document that pushed the Center for Constitutional Rights into action. Now, what are the elements that made up what my comrade Clark calls rolling coup? Clark was good enough to make a list for all of us, and I'm going to read that for you. The initial seizure of power by Bush when the Supreme Court refused to hold to allow a recount in Florida elections in the year 2000 starts there. Doctrine of global superiority and advocacy of preemptive war in Iraq and maybe now Iran. Remember, Congress has given Bush a carte blanche to launch a war against Iran. Bipartisan. He could do it. He may do it. Repudiation of treaties such as the ABM Treaty, refusal to recognize international law or applicability of the Geneva Accords, the roundup of immigrants after 9/11, people held without charges, domestic deployment of military as law enforcement, the Posse Comitatus Act from 1878 is out the window, establishment of military tribunals at Guantanamo, which I mentioned, secret deportation hearings, seizure of citizens as enemy combatants, effective end of habeas corpus, massive secret wiretaps in violation of the FISA law. That's come up in Congress. Both Obama and Clinton absented themselves from that vote. Issuance of secret administrative warrants of all kinds for records. They can get your government records, they can get your medical records, you don't even know they got them. Suppression of Muslim charities, secret sneak and peek searches so they can come into your office or your house and get whatever they want, and you never know they were there. Classification of most government records. It was the reversal of the idea that the government should be transparent, and if the government is a democracy, it's our government. So whatever records they have, they should give to us. Michael Ratner got the CIA dossier on Che Guevara, and we published it. We could never get that again. Ashcroft said, anybody asks for something, don't give it to them, and we'll defend you. Legitimization of torture. Special rendition, that's outsourcing torture. Establishment of privatized military contractors, like Khaki or Blackwater. You know, they had Blackwater patrolling the streets after they lost New Orleans. Assertion of executive supremacy through signing statements. Heidi's an expert on that if you want to ask her about it, but the long and the short of it is Bush has issued more signing statements saying he's going to ignore laws that are passed by Congress than all the other presidents of America combined. Expanded use of recess appointments. Doctrine of unitary executive. The $385 million this is icing on their cake. Kellogg Brown and Root, which is a subsidiary of Halliburton, got $385 million to set up a huge detention camp. And they said it's not just for immigrants. So well, what to do? How does this affect what may happen politically in the future? Imagine with me, if you will, the development of a pre-revolutionary situation in this country. Let's say there was another ecological disaster. Say Atlanta runs out of water, which it almost did a few months ago. Or let's say that all the nuclear weapons floating around the world, somebody gets their hands on one and detonates it, and there's a cloud that's drifting our way. Or let's say they attack Iran. Or let's say the recession that we're in, which is going to be very deep and very long, let's say it sprouts into a genuine depression and that there are tens of millions of people that are unemployed. That could very well happen. They've borrowed $3 million, mostly from the Chinese and from the Japanese, to fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's playing havoc with the economy. The Chinese and the Japanese don't want to call the loans back because they don't want to bring down the United States, because they want the United States to buy the stuff they manufacture. But it's all very tricky. There could very likely be an economic crisis. You get the idea. So, you know, things could get worse. And things getting worse don't put people into motion. Putting people into motion is they have some hopes that they can make things better. But let's say people do get into motion. Let's say, like during 1968, some of us remember that the anti-war movement was so well organized and so strong and so disgusted with Nixon when he bombed Cambodia, we shut down hundreds of campuses across the country and we opened them up as anti-war universities. And we had a huge demonstration in Washington. What if we have committees, anti-war committees, and we have ecology committees, and we've got fighting the depression committees? And what if they all get together? What if they start, you know, making demands on the government, like they're going to have a huge march on Washington, or they demand that the government give jobs to everybody at union wages, or they say that people working 40 hours should only work 30 hours so that the extra work can be spread out? I mean, you get the idea. What if a movement starts up like that? What if there's a general strike? Like in 1968, there was a general strike in France that the students triggered off. If it wasn't for the misleadership of the French Communist Party, there would have been a socialist France. De Gaulle was so convinced that they could lose there that he went to Belgium and he hid out. So what if there's a convergence of what we had in 68 and we have it here? Well, that's why I think, and Clark is going to give you a broader perspective historically on this, but that's why I think that they've done to the Constitution what they've done. Because they know that they're going to need these tools to hold on to power. And we should understand that. We should understand that to the marrow of our bones. What do we need to do about it? Just what we're doing now. Educate ourselves. Organize, organize, organize. Join a group. Find a group out there that you most agree with and join it. If you don't agree with any group out there, form your own group. But get organized. And remember what Frederick Douglass told us, that power concedes nothing without a demand. It never will and never has. That's what we have to do. I remember when we took over Wayne State University campus and the student newspaper, black anarcho-syndicalist group called the Dodge Revolutionary Movement, DRUM, in Detroit, had a slogan. And that slogan was on the campus newspaper, and it said, "Dare to struggle, dare to win." And that's what we should do. Thanks.